Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. We're back in our usual venue, having been in the dark hull of Calcutta for a while, which probably means that there are people wandering around in the theatrette in the dark looking for the lecture. However, we'll get started. I hope no one's going to ask me again, why do you always have professors? We have another professor today, but he's different from other professors because he's a Queenslander by adoption, and I'm reliably informed that his lectures attract more people than are actually enrolled in his courses, which is a very good sign. He's going to talk to us about developments in the party system. Please welcome Professor Paul Reynolds.
Thank you, Harry. Friends, ladies and gentlemen, former students, of which there are two at least, thank you for turning up. I wanted to talk to you about, I've entitled my talk anyway, Trends in the Australian Party System. And I want to do a bit of speculation because, for reasons I think which will become apparent as the paper progresses. So then, to turn to the introduction, political parties have for so long been an integral part of modern liberal democracies that one is apt to take them for granted. If not for granted, then as a given in the landscape of politics. The party system in Australia, in embryonic form, predates federation, although its rapid rise after 1901 is both a cause and a consequence of the federal process. It is one of the supreme ironies of federation in Australia that the Constitution was written by men who constituted the final generation of non-party politicians. In other words, the late 1890s was the last time possible for the Constitution to have been written sans parties. That having been said, the document proved to have been so flexibly drafted that lack of formal and constitutional recognition neither inhibited the rise of the parties to dominate the polity, nor did its operations and application by the High Court prevent their ongoing operations, much less threaten their legitimacy as cognate players in the political processes. Could that be the last one, please? I'm finding it quite distracting. Thank you. So then to the formation and roles of political parties. The number and reach of political parties in Australia over the last 120 years has been remarkable. We tend to think of the three majors, and I call them that for convenience, ALP, Liberal and Nationals, plus a couple of add-on minors as the sum total, as these represent the permanent players. However, at the state and local levels, parties have a rich history of formation, operation, decline and fall, or maybe morphing into another stage of political evolution. That having been said, two observations now seem warranted. First, parties are formed when a section of society feels that it has a claim on the political and decision-making process of the state, which is not being addressed by current persons or organisations. And I think the latest example of that can be seen in Pauline Hanson's escapade. The majors, of course, represent this proposition as textbook cases, especially the ALP, mobilising working class consciousness, and here I refer to Don Rawson's seminal article, The Lifespan of Labor Parties, which was written in 1969, and the Nationals giving political expression to country-mindedness, a concept propagated and produced by Don Aitken in his Stability and Change in Australian Politics. On the other hand, the Liberals, Nationalists, UAP were parliamentary organised parties without any durable mass base. And while this mass base was finally incorporated by Robert Menzies in 1944, the modern-day Liberal Party bears many of the hallmarks of an organisation constructed from the top down. Nevertheless, in class terms, it makes sense to view the Liberals as a case of middle-class mobilisation, at least insofar as the middle class was comprised in the first half of the 20th century. Second, in the 1960s, when I was an undergraduate, and the political science discipline was being established in this part of the world, we were taught that the difference between political parties and pressure groups, as they were then known, was that the latter, whether instrumental or promotional, did not seek office, nor pre-select candidates, nor become involved in the electoral processes, or if they did, only as a tactic to further their aims. As well, they were sectoral with limited policy horizons. Political parties, by contrast, sought office, had a broad whole-of-government approach to policy and were in the business of holding and wielding power rather than merely influencing its disposition in a limited direction. From the perspective of 40 years or so, such a taxonomy seems overly rigid, seeking hard and fast boundaries where none truly exist. The line between the two types of organisations, pressure groups and parties, has become extremely blurred, especially in regard to minor parties. These latter have no realistic expectations of gaining power, seldom have a big picture policy agenda, and even if they do, this is not what they're recognised for. Should they be successful in gaining upper house representation, they are apt to behave as pressure groups, depending on who holds power in these chambers. Conversely, major, permanent and institutionalised lobby groups certainly will interact with the government processes in the guise of, as the modern parlance has it, stakeholders. But this, while vital, will only be one set of their multitude of agendas and activities. The interplay of such forces, moreover, is maximised in a city such as Canberra, a dedicated federal capital, whose chief, perhaps sole, rationalisation is national governance. Now I want to talk a little bit about the functions performed by the party system. The most important explanation for the durability of the political parties is that simultaneously they perform a variety of functions, doing so economically, skillfully and purposefully. For convenience, I've listed six, though not in any order of importance. Policy formation and articulation. Secondly, the recruitment of political activists. Thirdly, training for leadership through internal party mechanisms and parliamentary service. Fourth, operating as electoral machines. Five, providing for and facilitating the circulation of political elites via the transfer of power. And finally, demarcating differing ideological positions within the polity. Now, if this were an undergraduate lecture, I would now discuss each point in some detail to give sense of the complexity of the process. But some people in this room will have heard this lecture before. Mr. Duckworth. However, in this instance, I want to observe that each of these roles has, over time, experienced profound change and metamorphosis. For example, parties do not now rely only on their internal processes to devise and propound policy. Rather, they draw policy inputs from an array of sources and process these according to the party's practices and LORE law. Recruitment of activists has become a specialised activity, as after the 1960s, the old mass memberships gave way to cadre parties, many recruited as university students and drawn from the sandpit of university union politics. Leaders are no longer folk heroes like John Curtin or patricians like Robert Menzies, but are apt to be made and unmade by opinion poll results and feedback from news media commentaries, including the incessant and mindless clamour of talkback radio and its shock jocks. As Emeritus Professor Joan Ryden was wont to observe, every year somewhere in Australia people are voting. This means that the parties are constantly on election alert, with all that this implies in funding, planning and resources. The leaders of the majors never survive an election defeat. I just pause here to reflect that Frank Nicklin, who was the first Country Party Premier of Queensland, elected in 1957 after the Labor split, led the Country Party to 5 successive electoral defeats before he won office. That is inconceivable today at any level that a leader would survive even one electoral defeat, let alone 5. So the leaders of the majors never survive election defeat, and even victory may not necessarily result in continuation of office. And here you can instance cases as disparate as Margaret Thatcher, Bob Hawke and Joe Bjelke-Petersen. What a trio. The circulation of elites is a constant, either through election results or more rarely on the floor of the House. That said, even the most casual perusal of the history of state and federal elections show that they mostly serve to confirm governments in office, and only occasionally, 4 times federally since 1969, change governments. something the students find quite remarkable when they reflect on it, that elections don't change governments, they confirm them in office. Not only then is the party system durable, it is so because it's sustained by even more durable patterns of partisanship. The role of ideology in the Australian party system has always been contentious, but one can discern a substratum of ideas, to put it no stronger, in the formation of both Labor and the Liberals. While it may be true that pragmatism will always win out, the corollary question must be, pragmatism for what? An indication that ideology can rescue the party system from sterile short-term activity. Whether the party system. In the light of the durability of the party system over the past century and more, it seems altogether unreasonable to question its future as a system if only because its existence and continuity is testimony to its ability to adapt to social and economic change, which has, in turn, shifted the balance of political forces within the parameters of the majors and politics. This notwithstanding, it's useful to delve below the surface of apparent functionality in the hope of discerning trends which may well exert significant influence on future directions within the overall system. First, it's as well to recall that the basis for the Australian party system is the state branch. Indeed, it was not until the 1960s that the majors established federal secretariats, and not until the 1970s that the state branches surrendered to their federal counterparts the running of national election campaigns. Despite these developments, the state branches enjoy considerable autonomy and power over their own affairs. They pre-select and deselect candidates. They train generations of politicians at federal, state and local government levels. They operate as significant fundraisers, especially if they're in government. They send delegates to national conferences and federal executives and manifest themselves as their party's sinews of war. While in theory the Liberal federal executive can interfere in the affairs of a state branch, this is a comparatively recent development and has never occurred. I'm not aware of any such power in the National Party. And even in the case of the Labor Party, where this power certainly does exist, it was exercised three times between 1970 and 1981, and never thereafter. On those occasions when the ALP Federal Executive did so act, this action crucially depended on the factional balance then obtaining on the Executive. Further to this general point, the state of the parties federally, and hence the party system, depends on how the parties are travelling at the subnational level. The current situation, where all states and territories are controlled by the ALP, which has been out of power federally since 1996, is almost unprecedented. There was a brief period in the late 1960s when Labor was out of power in all jurisdictions. This then gives rise to two further considerations. The first is that, as federations go, Australia is not all that pluralistic, certainly insofar as race, language, religion and regional diversities are concerned. However, precisely because of this, it can be argued that our interstate differences are more subtle and nuanced, with each party branch taking on its own characteristics and folkways appropriate to that of the state's political culture. While it would require a thorough, in-depth investigation and research to explore the detailed working out of these processes, it means at the very least that a good deal of state and territory diversity lurks under the generic party labels. A second consideration is that the state branches hold the key to their party's ongoing credibility and durability. To take the case of the Nationals, in their first and founding state, Western Australia, they no longer exist, at least for federal purposes. Notwithstanding their ambitious name, they exist as a force at all, only because they have a political presence in New South Wales and Queensland, and to a far lesser extent, Victoria. A further case concerns the Liberals in Queensland. They ceased to be a credible force in state politics in 1983, save for a brief and impermanent revival between 1995 and 1998. They have only sustained themselves as the Federal Liberals' northern postbox because in south-east Queensland, one voter in five chooses to vote Labor, that is Peter Beattie, at state level, but vote for the Liberals federally. I have that from a research student of mine called Daniel Sheverton, who wrote a research paper on this called The Gemini Vote. Should this pattern not survive 2007, the Liberals in Queensland at both levels will be in grave danger of decline into total irrelevancy. My second wider point concerns the circulation of leaders and elites. While it is self-evidently true that Australia is a stable democracy and that legitimacy of governments or leaders is not an issue, with of course the obvious exception being 1975, it is somewhat sobering to recall that of federal leaders and prime ministers since 1945, only Menzies retired at his own time and with his own choice. All others were defeated electorally or cut down in their party room or both. This observation then leads to a further consideration on leadership itself. The experience of the federal Liberals with the leadership issue between 1983 and 1996 and that of the Labor Party since 1996 so shows how hard it can be for parties out of office to bring their leadership cycle into conjunction with public expectations when these expectations are established by the government of the day deploying all its considerable resources. This then is all the more problematical because the evolution of the Prime Minister's position into a presidential style of office with all the accompanying concentration of power, effort, resources and attention. But the paradox remains that while the trappings of office bespeak permanency, the position of any incumbent is at best transitory. With no hereditary monarch as head of government rather than as head of state, and without a president elected at large, limited to a number of specific terms, the bestowal and withdrawal of leadership will remain with the parliamentary parties, where, in the absence of a separation of powers between the executive and the legislature, it will ever reside. My third and final point concerns the interplay between the major parties and the minor parties. It's interesting to reflect that there were no minor parties in existence in 1948 when proportional representation was introduced for Senate elections. However, with the advent of the Democratic Labor Party in 1955, two electoral trends were established. The first was that a minor party with a disciplined support base could exert a totally disproportionate influence on electoral outcomes through the direction of its preferences. In the Deal's Peace case, it actually saved coalition government in 1961 and 1969 from defeat. The second was that PR created an opportunity for parliamentary representation via the Senate, and this in turn meant the chance to hold the balance of power. Both trends survived the demise of the DLP in 1974, the difference being that there have been several claimants for the balance of power in more recent times, including one individual in former Senator Harravine. While the current minor parties are not as bloody-minded over preferences as was the DLP, the major parties have to build their minor counterparts into their electoral tactics in ways unknown in a first-past-the-post electoral system. The widespread negative reaction expressed in 2004 when the coalition took control of the Senate suggested that over the previous quarter of a century it had become a popular belief that government should not control the Senate. It'll be interesting to see if and how far that sentiment translates this election year. And so happily for you all, the conclusion. The party system in Australia has developed its own dynamic. It has socialised successive generations into support for its protagonists and has for many become coterminous with the whole political system. The party system itself has profited from two institutional changes, namely compulsory voting, which frees the parties from the tedium and expense of having to get out the vote and for the public has become a civic virtue, while the other development, public funding, guarantees all who qualify a financial base while giving the miners more room to operate than they could otherwise expect. The warning then, insofar as there is one, is that the federal parties are only as strong as their state bases. The first half of the last century was characterised by instability in both the Labor Party and urban non-Labor. Labor split three times between 1916 and 1955, while urban non-Labor had to be reinvented four times between 1910 and 1944. By contrast, the second half of the 20th century was marked by major party stability and minor party amoeba-like formation and reformation. One distinctiveness that the Australian party system has compared to its New Zealand, United Kingdom and Canadian counterparts is the formation and survival of the Nationals. While the majors can expect to go through their electoral cycles as mirror images of each other, an indication of the ongoing health of the party system can be discerned from the size, vitality and success of the minors, which collectively measure the contentment or otherwise of the electorate with the party system. Thank you.
Well, we have been rather generously left with time for any questions, so I invite any questioners to ask some questions. Could any questions go to the microphones? And there's one upstairs there too.
Professor, you finished up talking about the ongoing health of the party system, yet I think it's well accepted that the party membership is in decline. You talked originally about, say, the 1960s or earlier, when party membership was quite substantial. Today it is quite small. What do you think the implications of that are for the party system and for the health of the democratic system?
Yes, that's a good question, and it's something the students quite frequently raise as well. Can I put it in a slightly broader context? Until about the 1960s and 70s, we were a society where people joined and belonged to organisations. Churches, trade unions, political parties, Boy Scouts, you know, hundreds of those sort of community organisations. Now, all that's disappeared. In fact, Professor Hughes, who was your lecturer last month, once observed to me when he was the electoral commissioner that he could chart the decline of organised religion in Australia. I said, what, from the Australian Electoral Commission? He said, yes, Paul, there are no Sunday school halls left we can use for polling booths.
we have to use primary schools now.
So in the sort of decline of public membership of voluntary groups, it would be quite amazing if political parties were exempt from this. And anecdotally, about 20 years ago, if the students wanted to become active in the political processes, they went and joined pressure groups, Amnesty International, those sorts of groups, Save the Whales, Land Rights for Gay Whales, all that kind of stuff. But what I've noticed now is the political activists, kids I teach, are now going back to the political parties because they see the parties as career paths. And so what the parties have lost in terms of foot soldiers, they've sort of gained in officers. So whether you call that a quality shift or not, I don't know. But the mass-based party is a thing of the past, as is the mass-based almost anything, you know, fill in the gap, fill in the blank. But so long as the parties are recruiting activists, training them as the key political players, and collectively I use the term political elites, then the party system will survive, but not in the sense of the old mass-based party where everybody turned up on a windy Monday night once a month to fight about who owned the Gestetner or who's going to sell the Chook raffle tickets. And that's gone. It may be, of course, that the parties will suffer in another sense in that they won't have people available to sort of hand out the how-to-vote cards and stuff. But my suspicion is that a lot, without the parties admitting this, that in quite a number of instances they're already paying people to do that. They're not depending on local branch members because they haven't got any, so they can, you know, give it to students or schoolboys or something like that to do that job. But, of course, and I'll finish on this point, compulsory voting really means that the parties don't have to have mass memberships. I mean, if you're in Britain or the United or New Zealand, where voting is voluntary, a hell of a lot of the foot soldier work of the branch members is to make sure that potential supporters of your party are on the electoral roll, and then on election day go and get them and physically take them to the polling booth. Now, compulsory voting, which started in Queensland in 1914 and was adopted by the Commonwealth in 1924, has never been seriously questioned except by a few right-wing liberals from time to time. And the parties want it, and people think it's a civic duty. But my American students who are here on study abroad schemes are horrified that we compel people to vote. Well, there you go.
Do we have a questioner in the upper gallery there?
I heard on public radio recently, is this on? Yep.
Yep.
That the description of the two American parties was that they were empty shells to be filled by the interests of lobby groups. In Australia, partly because of the mass base disappearing, do you think that's an adequate description of either where we are now or where we're likely to go, where the political parties, in the absence of a hard left or right, will just become empty shells fillable by pressure groups or lobby groups?
It's a good question. The short answer is no, it won't, because the party system in the two countries are not strictly comparable. The parties in America are not mass-based, but they are a collection of pluralist interests. So the Democratic Party, Hispanics, blacks, feminists, gays, blue-collar workers, and so on. They're umbrella parties. Our parties are much more exclusivist than that. They're not umbrella parties. Consequently, in Australia, the party discipline is much tighter. And that means, amongst other things, that the parties are not susceptible to being captured by lobby groups and pressure groups and other stakeholders. These people can importune the parties and try to get their ideas and agendas on the party's policy priority list. But the party retains control over its policy agenda, and no political leadership of any political party would surrender that. Also, because the parties in Australia are more ideologically defined than they are in America, certain lobbyists will gravitate to one party and not to another, which means that each, if you like, the two majors, each have their own client groups. And the interplay between the party and its client group will be an ever-changing relationship according to the exigencies of the time and the sort of processes that are around at the time with the rise and decay of issues. Of course, it would be foolish to rule out that forever, but I think the structure of the party system and the interplay between the client groups and the parties in Australia would preclude us becoming Americanised to that extent.
Now, there was a question over here, thank you.
Thanks for your talk. I'd just like to invite your comments on two theories which we commonly hear these days. Firstly, the theory that voters like to balance one party at the federal level with the opposite party at state level. And secondly, the theory that ideology has disappeared from politics at state level at least, and that it's voters simply choose which is the best party for service delivery.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you repeat the first question? Well, Daniel Sheverton's work, I cited, at least suggests that that's happening in Queensland. On the other hand, Queensland's a peculiar state, and that's in this sense, that split-ticket voting is what the Americans call the phenomenon you've described, was always a viable option for non-Labor voters, because what they tended to do when they had the opportunity was to vote Liberal federally and national state, because you were assured of victory in both kind of things, if you want to keep Labor out. What we've now got since 1989 in Queensland, with the post-Fitzgerald era, is that people have crossed party lines and they're doing this balancing act. It's a minor phenomenon in the sense that Sheverton suggested only one voter in five in southeast Queensland was doing this, and commentators have picked this up in Sydney as well, but only in certain areas in Sydney. I'm not aware that there's much evidence for it anywhere else. So I think the theory is needs more investigation. And there may be something in it, but I think we just don't have the data yet to run with it. It would be a good PhD thesis, think about it. And the second one? Well, I would doubt that political parties at the state level really did much to peddle ideology, except in very situationally specific instances. And here I return to my state of Queensland. The Labor Party was at its most radical in Queensland in the 1920s when it had a majority of four. And what it did was amalgamate the Brisbane City Council, put in a state government insurance office, abolished the Legislative Council, abolished hanging, and the state ran butcher shops. Now, this was kind of utopian socialism, if you like. If Joe Bjelke-Petersen could have spelt ideology, I would have passed him and awarded him an honorary doctorate. So I don't think that ideology has ever figured much. Maybe in New South Wales from time to time, but, I mean, populism has always had more currency as a political style at state level than ideology. And sure, you can morph populism into ideology, but it's a pretty poor fit. It's a style rather than an ideology, I would suggest. But certainly I think the latter part of the point is well taken, that the states are now seen as service delivery vehicles. And there's an interesting instance of this. It's largely that realisation has really dawned on state populations with the advent of the GST. And one of my close friends, Dr. David Hamill, who was State Treasurer of Queensland from 1998 to 2001, produced a PhD thesis in record time, 2.5 years part-time, which, of course, had the rest of our PhD students grinding their teeth in fury. But David, just when he retired from politics, took all his papers from the Treasury office and took home in Ipswich and then wrote a PhD. But what David was able to demonstrate very clearly was that while the states have more money, they have far less control over it. So the GST has certainly been money bags for the states, but the money comes very tightly controlled from Canberra. So the states, yes, service delivery, particularly in times of drought, water shortage, all that kind of stuff, that's the cutting edge of the service delivery. And you'll get more votes for promising a decent road than you will from propounding the necessity to have state-run butcher shops.
Other questions? Yep.
A question about the difference between political parties. When I was growing up, and the family that I grew up in, the politics were always well and truly over to the left. And my father always said to me, I want you to remember that the letters ALP stand for Alternative Liberal Party. And the point that he made was that there was no real fundamental differences between these two parties, and that people were deluding themselves if they thought that there were any fundamental differences. And that was 50 years ago that my father mentioned that, and I'm wondering whether you see any fundamental differences. They appear to me, when you look at the statements of people like Mr. Rudd, one of the very first statements he says, I believe in the market economy. The word socialism, for example, is not mentioned. It's essentially two parties who argue about the management of the economy for those who own and control it, those who own businesses, and especially those who own big businesses. I'd like to hear what your views are on whether you think that there are irreconcilable and deep differences between these two parties.
Okay. It's a question that's frequently raised and it deserves a serious answer. I would start the answer by saying that there never was deep and irreconcilable differences of an ideological kind between the political parties from the 1890s onwards. There were always alternative ways of doing things, and you've got to remember that the first half of the 20th century was essentially the struggle to develop and put in place the welfare state. And there was only one party that was going to do that, and that was the Labor Party. So the Labor Party got its distinctiveness for the first 50 years of its life because it had a fundamental goal, and that was the establishment of comprehensive welfare. This was what Rawson and others have meant by working class mobilisation. Now, what happened all over the Western world after World War II was that the welfare state was established by left-of-centre parties, partly as a result of the hideous effects of the Great Depression. Now, conservative parties hopped on the bandwagon in the 1950s, and they were able to present themselves in Australia and the UK and America and New Zealand and everywhere else just about as the true managers of the welfare state. They weren't going to dismantle the welfare state, but they're going to run it according to business principles. And for about a generation, Labor lost its way. It had done what it set out to do. Now, what else did? What was it going to do? You had books in the UK by Richard Crossman, for example, in the early 60s, The Future of Socialism. Another one by Mark Abrams, Must Labor Lose? These were periods of self-doubt and very profound self-questioning on the left as to what do you do now? So socialism in Australia only ever meant the establishment of the welfare state. Certainly the hard left could bang on about Marxism, and for a time the communists got a bit of airplay in the 30s and 40s, but the Labor Party wiped them out as any organised force in Australian politics. So what we have now is another period of consensus. Globalisation, rationalisation of markets, market forces, free trade, all of this sort of stuff. After 100 years, free trade is back as the orthodox belief system of economists. So naturally enough, the parties are going to pursue where the consensus path. So of course the argument is going to be about who runs the show best. And the corollary question answer to that is who profits the most. Now, if you look at Howard's legislation, for example, on industrial relations, you can say that this is the most ideological right-wing government we've ever had in Australia, which is probably true. But Howard sells the industrial relations packages as being beneficial to the vast majority of workers. And that's where the debate is joined. And that it is ever thus in Australia, that the debate is always joined on the outcomes, on the output, not on the input or the rationale. It's who gets what, when, why and how, as Robert Dahl famously articulated it in the 1950s. So you've got a situation, therefore, where the observable phenomenon is what governments produce and what governments do, and that's where the political argument is. And it was ever thus in Australia, whatever anybody's father said about it.
Any other questions?
Professor, I believe that in Australia the politics is different from the United States and the UK because you get more dissent in within the parliamentary system. But with our tight control of the parties, the Labor Party, if you vote against it, you're out. The Liberal Party gives you a conscience vote if John Howard will allow you to have it. Now, how do we go in the 21st century with such tight control? Are we going to lose some aspects of democracy?
No, I don't think so. But I think, again, it comes down to the contextualisation of the question. Remember that the UK is not a federation. So it only has one parliament. And that parliament has 650 members. Now, with the best ironclad discipline in the world, you're going to be herding cats with 650 people. Also, in the UK, because the House of Commons is so large, most members will be no more than backbenchers. Only a very tiny percentage of members will end up as ministers or anywhere on the political radar. And the House of Lords, because it contains the Lords spiritual and temporal, is only a delaying tactic. And they're trying to get rid of it. As the Economist said to the latest tranche of House of Lords reforms, to the House of Lords, welcome to the 18th century. So that's one reason why party discipline in Britain seems not as tight as in Australia. It's a sort of a function of size. Now, in the United States, as I've already mentioned in an earlier response to an earlier question, the parties are coalitions of interests. So, therefore, the party discipline is much weaker. And cross-party voting is something which is a way of life, and it's built into the political processes. It's always expected that there'll be Conservative Democrats and Liberal Republicans, and occasionally, well, depending on the circumstance, they'll cross the floor. Now, in Australia, by contrast, we have small parliaments. The biggest parliament is the House of Representatives with 150 members. And you can go right down to Tassie where there's, what, I think about 27 or something like that. Now, in those circumstances, it's much easier to control the behaviour of the politicians in parliament. And remember that the politicians are not controlled externally. They make their own rules in their caucuses and party rooms. That's where the dissent is ironed out. And that's what you don't hear about because the Chatham House rules are firmly enforced in caucus discussions. So the product, therefore, is solidarity and unity and presenting a united front to the public. This, of course, is facilitated very largely because 80% of all parliamentary business is non-controversial. Governments only are governments of innovation, generally speaking, in their first term. Thereafter, they are governments of administration. This is what makes the Howard government so different, because it has been innovative all the way through. I might sort of suggest here that political parties are captives of their own myths. The Labor Party myth is that Whitlam failed because he tried to do too much too quickly. So Labor governments ever after have been quite cautious. The Liberal Party's myth is that Fraser wasted 8 years to remake Australia in the Conservative mould. So the tightness of the discipline can be seen as stifling democracy, but I think it's rather, I prefer the analogy that it's having two footy teams. They can only compete successfully if they're united and purposeful and aiming to win. And I wouldn't want to push the football politics analogy too far, but I think that gives you a sense of the question, as Jim Killen used to put it, not all the best players are on the one team. But I always like Paul Keating's reply to that: our bastards are better than their good guys.
Who are the equivalent of the Judiciary Committee? In the Yes, another question, a brief one.
A very brief one. You have done the impossible. When you gave your description, I said there's no future for the voters in this country. We'll have to wait for the Chinese to take us over and show how it can be done.
Well, there's a response to that.
Well, I can tell you just a quick humorous analogy. I won't name the gentleman, although he's now dead. It was said of a former governor of Queensland that the Chinese landed today, he'd have plastic surgery tomorrow.
Okay, we've got time for one last question. Any last penetrating question? No? If not, well, yes, yes. Is it penetrating?
I wanted to ask you, Professor, if you have any views on the funding for elections, and the fact is the federal government gives so much money per vote. Mm. Thank you very much.
Yes. Yes, that was an innovation that was brought in with the last tranche of electoral reforms in 1984. And it was designed to do two things, I guess. One was to give the parties a public funding base where they would be accountable. It's not just they don't just get the dough for the votes, but they've got to be they've got to furnish all kinds of returns to the Electoral Commission, and they're accountable. The second one was to obviate the danger that the gentleman in the gallery referred to of having the parties captive of lobby groups. That if the parties depend on corporate, the big end of town, corporate donations, trade unions, whatever, then they are in danger of being enthralled to those groups, either on specific or general grounds. The other unintended consequence was, as I said, to give the minor parties a more secure financial base than they would otherwise have. Now,
those are the practicalities of it. That was the sort of pragmatic rationale for it. You can argue the morality of it till the cows come home. I mean, again, to use the example of my American study abroad students, they think it's appalling that the state should give money to political parties. Some people would say it's appalling that American politics is run by the tobacco companies and the anti-abortion lobby. So it's where you pay your money and you take your choice, the pun's intended. In other words, if you're going to have public funding, it is what it says, public funding. It's publicly accountable. The parties are accountable for the funding that they get. If you don't have public funding, you say this is an illegitimate thing for the taxpayer to be footing the bill for, then you say, well, the political parties can go and beat the bushes and get the money wherever they like, and we'll never know what strings were attached to the money. Of course, public fund, it's not an either-or situation either, because the political parties can go out and do go out and solicit donations and to top up the public funding. But here, they have to declare to the Electoral Commission who gave the money and how much was given. And that's public. That's on the public record. So the reforms of 1984 were intended to balance two sets of interests, to secure the parties on a financial basis without sleazy deals, and also to give the miners a bit of airplay. The fact that it isn't an issue in politics now, and wasn't particularly controversial 20 years ago either, is that most people, I think, accept the rationale for public funding, provided the safeguards are in place. Does that answer the question? Well, everything increases, doesn't it? Prices, taxes, everything. So, yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay, please join me in thanking our lecturer for a very stimulating session. Thank you.
One lecture and many lectures.
Thank you very much.